Cultural stigma surrounding mental health is one of the biggest obstacles of people, especially men, to admit they are struggling and need help. On today's podcast, I chat with Colm Doane, the founder of the Sober Mess podcast. Colm speaks openly and honestly about his personal struggles with his mental health, his grief through losing his father, and how by adhering to the 12-step program has brought him sobriety and peace, enjoying life's natural resources. Well, welcome, Colm. How are you doing?
I'm good today, Rona. Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all.
It's a privilege. It's an absolute privilege. I'm just thinking that you have a Donegal accent, I have a Dublin accent. I really hope we don't get a lot of international listeners. Hopefully Sean can put a few subtitles on.
Exactly.
Because I only talk in two speeds, it's fast and faster. So.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm the same too as well. Actually, see, when I was actually starting this off, my mama says to me, Bruna, slow it down. I was like, right, okay, I'll slow it down.
I remember I was backpacking in America a few years ago, and yeah. I had a mate that lives in California, and he does all these kind of wellness retreats and all. And I was there at the time, and he's like, oh, will you come in and do a bit of a talk? You can talk about like not drinking and what you do to get a buzz nowadays. I was like, oh yeah, cool, no worries. Yeah. So I walk into this this venue in California, in LA, and I walk in and there's like 200 people, and I was like, oh shit myself. No. So I'm freaking out, getting mad and nervous, and I'm drinking like loads and loads of coffee, like as you do when you're nervous, right? The anxiety going through the roof. So I get up on stage and I start giving this talk, you know, then the ego kicks in. Next thing I think I'm doing it, like I think I'm Tony Robbins or something, doing the TED Talks, and I finish, and there's just this, and there's like a Q&A then at the end of it. So has anyone got any questions? Like 10 minutes silence, absolutely no one that said anything. There's like this American lad in the front row, and I said, all right mate, have you got any questions? He's like, man, I didn't hear a goddamn thing you just said, but I love your accent.
Funny you actually say that. Actually happened to us too as well when we were in Florida too. I swear to God, they just, the Americans, they just absolutely love our accent, don't they? Literally do.
Yeah.
And they said they us one time too as well. I think it was me and my dad actually. And they said, so you guys into corned beef and cabbage? And I was like, no, I've never had the both in a combo. Definitely not. Yeah. No, definitely not. That didn't happen, no.
Oh, stop. And my mate, he was working in Starbucks over there for a while. His name's Owen, but he spells it like E-O-G-H-A-N.
My cousin does the same. That's spelling, yeah.
Yeah, and it'd be like guys coming in and like people like, oh, you're Ogan. No, you're from Ireland, are you?
Shies, do you always get Brina?
Yeah.
Brina?
It's mad, isn't it? Do you know any of the Burns? You wouldn't know Mary Byrne from Donegal, do you? And he'd be like, oh, Mary, yeah. Well, she's my sister's cat's kitten's goldfish, the second cousin. I said, no.
And you know what? Another fact, I remember too, the last time we were there, they says, you know, where are you from or wherever? And we were all Derry, and they were like, oh my God, you guys from the conflict zone? It's like, no, definitely not. We're just normal people. Like,
that's really funny. I was on a Zoom call there. It was like an online thing. There was a few different people on, a few people from Ireland and a few people from America. And this lady came on and everyone was saying where they're from. And this lady came on, oh, I'm from Mississippi, and it's in the beautiful old state of Alabama. And then this lad was on and goes, oh, how are you? I'm John. I'm from Blanche. And the lady turns around, what state is Blanchestown in, John? And he said, it's in an awful fucking state.
Oh jeez. So Colm, take us right back to the very, very start
of my story.
No worries.
I suppose from day one, I had an absolutely incredible childhood until I was about two. Then my brothers were born. I think,
are you the youngest, oldest, middle?
So I am the middle kid of eight kids.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's eight of us. So it was a big family.
Yeah.
Like my mom used to just get us to stretch Armstrong between us for Christmas, and we just have a wrestling match. But I came from a perfectly normal, dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of way. Very, very big, very loving family, you know. My dad was a grafter, and my mom was kind of, you know, she was a full-time mommy.
Yeah.
And I suppose for me, I kind of had this underlying kind of sense of fear and anxiety.
Right.
You know what I mean? I just always felt different. And I felt like a black sheep. If it was out in the schoolyard or, you know, around the family table or at the football team, I always just felt less than everybody else. I kind of had like this 80% feeling.
From such a young age?
I'd feel like I was only 80%. Like everyone was 100% and I was only 80%. And I'd always feel like I'd have to do something to make up that 20%. And I had this very extreme low self-esteem, sense of low self-worth. I just always felt different. And I always had to, I felt weird. So it's like I nearly had to pretend to be normal. Yeah. You know what I mean? And as I got older, my mom and dad got a divorce. So my dad would have been an alcoholic and my mom was a kind of geographical move. And I think her way of dealing with that was to move. And a kind of her kind of like idea was that the next house that we'd move into would solve all the problems. You know what I mean? And that was her thing. And I suppose I learned
from... I get that 100% because like even with a... I know it's very different because I know that was a divorce or whatever, but like... I know when Berkey passed, that when I passed on that house, I had to get away from that house.
Yeah.
I had to, like, and I bought another house straight away because I just couldn't. I just wanted, you know, his memory and everything was going to be always with us, but I just couldn't stay in that home. Do you know what I mean?
It's powerful, isn't it? Because I think it's just so hard to sit with feelings sometimes. 100%. I was like, I remember someone using the analogy. It's like when you're on holidays and you're walking on the beach and the sand is so warm and hot that you can't just stand there. It's too painful. So that pain is either going to drive you to run into the ocean or run into the shade. But either way, it's a motivator or an enabler.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I learned that from a very young age. That I can find something on the outside of me to try and solve the fires on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember as a kid, you know, my mom, like, seven kids, you know, or eight kids. So chocolate and things like that were scarce, you know what I mean? But I remember one day, I used to hide them around the house and I'd find a pack of wagon wheels and I'd open a pack of wagon wheels and eat them all. And just the sugar rush I used to get.
Okay.
And I loved that high. And straight away, that need for more, that if we get more and more and more, it'd feel better.
Yeah.
You know, regardless how sick I felt, it was just
chasing. Having that high.
Having the high, you know.
Yeah.
And then it was the same with playing football. I used to play football all day. Like, out with the friends go in, I'd be sitting outside all day. Didn't want to go home.
Yeah.
You know, because I never, like, I suppose my home was a bit different from everyone else's home.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I go around to friends' houses and I say, well, this is what... Like, this is what it's like to have a normal house. Like, I'd be watching, like, over my friend's house, watching, like, just the way their family dynamics were and just feeling, like, a sense of envy.
Mm-hmm.
That, wow, this is what, like, their family seems so normal. The house seems so clean. The mom even makes nicer toast than my ma. Like, I grew up with a microwave mammy. Like, if you seen
I'm
someone...
I'm a microwave mammy.
Oh, have you seen some of the dinners
I can't
got?
Cook. I swear to God, I am... Shocking.
Oh, so my mat tries to put the Christmas turkey and all in the microwave. You know? If you've seen some of the dinners we got as grown up, you'd be taking into care. You've got the child.
I like, swear, see if I didn't have my mama, I don't know. Them wains, God bless the hand of God on them. I swear I can't. No, and that's one of my goals this year is by the end of the year to, you know, even start using a slow cooker or whatever, do you know? But I am, no, I'm shocking.
Oh, it's mad. I'm a boiler. I'm not even a cooker. I just boil everything. Like, you know what I mean?
Aye.
I just learned to boil, like, everything. Like, if I can't boil it, probably don't eat
no,
it.
No, like. It's got that stage in my house now. If anybody comes on or whatever and put the kettle on or whatever, don't let Bruna make the tea or the coffee. It's that bad. It's like tar.
No, you can't even make tea or coffee.
Not very good at it. No.
One thing, since I've got sober, I've got ridiculously good at making tea. I make a mean cup of tea.
Oh,
and my dad had me from a very young age making tea since I was two.
I love
me tea and coffee. So my mom would have moved around quite a lot.
Right.
And so I was in a lot of different schools. Mayo, Athlone, Wexford, Dublin. And I found that when I was in all these different schools, I came really good at being like a chameleon. Like, I'd blend into my environment and my surroundings, like, you know. And I remember when I first moved down to Wexford, and we're in this little town called Ballygarra, and I remember my mom saying, "I don't worry, you'll make loads of friends, and like, you know, don't be worrying about that, and you know, you can go back and see your old friends in Dublin at the weekend, so you'll have two bunches of friends." Yeah. You know, yeah. It's like, oh yeah, deadly. So I remember going out to the yard out in Wexford, and this school. And this skit, like in Ballygardens, it's a country, proper country town. This is about 15, 20 years ago. And all these kids going, "You're from Dublin, are you?" And he says, "Yeah." And he goes, "I bet you smoke heroin and you rob cars." And I'm like, "I'm only 8 years old, you know?" So it was kind of, you know, it felt like the outsider there. And then at the weekend, I go back up to see my mates in Dublin. And they'd be like, "Oh, here's the culture now. Here's the culture from the farmer, from Wexford," like, you know. So I didn't fit in anywhere.
Okay.
You know, I didn't fit in anywhere. And I was in a lot of trouble in school as well. I think that was me just kind of acting out, you know. I remember getting diagnosed with all sorts of things, right. ADHD, OCD, BBC, TV3, you know, everything was just labelled on me, you know. And
was that hard?
I think when you're that young and you feel already different, and then you're getting labelled even more. And I think what it was, I was just so interested in what was going on outside the window, rather than what was going on the board. I just wasn't stimulated with classwork. Like, I just...
I get that. I was the same. I absolutely hated school.
Yeah.
Hated it. I really did. Came out with one GCSE. Not that it didn't define me as a person, but I just absolutely... I rather just took a hand. Do you know that kind of way? I just wasn't... I'd never had the functioning for... I don't know. I really struggled too as well in school. I really did.
Yeah, and it's that thing. Like, I think I left school quite young as well, you know what I mean? And like that, I didn't, that's a school, like, there's so many different types of people in the world. You know, if you look at a tribe, you know, you have a healer, you have a communicator, you have a joker, you know, you have a leader, you have a preacher, you know, you have all these different people, but like, school is designed to condition us all in the one way. You know what I mean? Like, and it's designed to always get us ready for the next thing. Like,
100%.
We go to play school to get ready for primary school. We go to primary school to get ready for secondary school. We go to secondary school to get ready for college, to get ready for a job, to get ready to pay for a mortgage, etc. And we're never actually in the moment. We're always going ready for the next thing.
Yeah, like, definitely. You know what I mean? Even with schools too as well. Like, they never taught you about grief. They never taught you really much about money side of things. And do you know, I think that that needs to be brought on the schools too as well, more that, like, life reality things, that this is what happens and this is what you may overcome in life. Do you know what I mean? Do you know? Definitely. Like,
I know, 100%. And that's the sad thing, that a lot of time kids, and including myself, people only find out about resources for mental health and addiction when that fire alarm's already going off.
Absolutely.
You know, I was sitting in my old job having panic attacks and just saying, "I'll get another coffee or I'll buy something online and hopefully that'll help." And not knowing how to deal with this stuff. Like, and you'd never be sitting around with the lads saying, does anyone else get panic attacks? Or, you know, does anyone else feel this or feel that? And it wouldn't be something you talk about.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a narrative, especially among men, like, you know. But then you're ringing these mental health phone lines, and because it's the last straw, like, what else do you do? And it's not, like, nothing against my parents, I suppose, they didn't know. They done the best they could with what they had.
Yeah.
If you asked me about a couple of years ago about my childhood, I tell you I had a really hard childhood. You ask me about my childhood today, I tell you I had a really good childhood. Because it's been able to look back with a bit of compassion and say, look, that, you know, people do the best they can with what they know. You know 100%. What I mean? And I suppose the life skills and the skill set that you're given growing up, that was taught to my parents and their parents and their parents. And then it's taught on. And no one's kind of taught about emotions or inner narratives or the negative stream of thoughts. And I had that inner critic in my head. My default was discomfort. My default was really low self-esteem. I was feeling different, you know, all this. And I didn't know how to articulate it. Like, if I had said to me, "Ma, hey, Mom, I'm feeling anxious," you'd probably, "Why don't you try drinking some flat 7 up?
Or, exactly.
You know, say the rosary, you know, or something like that, you know. And
that's like old school ways too, as well, isn't it? Do you know, like, I definitely, like, I've been in situations before where, you know, maybe older generation have said to me, you know, "Don't you be crying in front of them wains, you know, don't you be doing that," or, you know, and stuff like that there. I think it's because, you know, we don't know what way to cope with things sometimes too. Yeah. And especially think with men too, do you know, men's mental health, big time, men can press it down as much as I can, I have a grand. I'll go a walk, or I'll do this or do that. But they don't actually, you know, tackle the emotion side of things too as well. Do you know?
100%. And that's exactly what it was with me. I keep pushing it down until I manifest it into something else. I don't know if you ever seen that series of The Simpsons where they're pushing all the rubbish under the carpet and they're just walking around the house and you can see the couch and the TV moving around because there's so much rubbish underneath the carpet. And that was like my emotional health. I didn't know how to deal with it. So I just pushed it in the backseat and just... was and just toughened up, you know what I mean? As you do, you're that age, you know, you don't want to show any feelings at all. You just want to toughen up or find a way to numb it. And I think then when I did find alcohol, you know, and that feeling that alcohol gave me was incredible.
And what age were you then?
I would have been 13 when I had my first drink, and I remember it like it was. I remember it like it was yesterday. You know, I remember going down to the field. And drinking with the lads. And I remember this feeling of taboo because I seen what alcohol done in my family, you know, I seen with my dad and my brothers and, you know, uncles and that, you know. Street was always taboo. But I remember taking a sip out of the can and being like, this is Dutch Gold. Like, Dutch Gold is absolutely, like, it's disgusting, like, at the time. Like.
Yeah.
And I remember taking a sip out of this can and getting a bit of a buzz. And then I had two cans, and then I had three cans, and I was absolutely mouldy. And I remember walking home with the lads, could barely stand up. And I seen a wheelie bin and I just ran over, climbing the wheelie bin, and the wheelie bin fell over. And all the lads came over there laughing and joking and picked me up and started celebrating and going, that was hilarious.
Yeah.
Fair play to you. And I just remember getting this feeling of, yes,
this
is what it's like to be like. This is what it's like to be approved of. This is what it's like to be validated. And I just felt like, oh, you have arrived. This is what I was missing. And straight away I realised my problem wasn't alcohol. Like, alcohol was my solution.
Right.
My problem was life. My problem was reality.
Yeah.
And I found the solution. I found what I was missing.
Because
I was walking around with this massive void and, you know, my whole life, and then found drink. And it was just that relief that I was like, oh, well, like, now I knew what was wrong. You know, and I think at that age, you know, when I was drinking and getting into trouble, you kind of got away with it because it was like cute, or it was like, ah, he's only a kid and bygones and bygones. But then, you know, you see your friends and all getting on with their lives and you're kind of still drinking like that 14-year-old, like, you know. But I kept, no matter how bad the consequences were, I kept going back because of the effect that drink. Like, I'd be, when I was sober, I couldn't talk to girls, I'd feel so nervous, I couldn't make the lads laugh, I'd be so self-conscious, you know, I'd be just so awkward.
So you needed that buzz?
I needed that. When I had a drink, I felt so relaxed. I felt like fucking, like, Stephen Fry and Tommy Tiernan and fucking, you know, Brad Pitt all put into one person.
Yeah.
And I loved that effect a couple of points had. Like, I remember walking into a pub and this old stinking pub that, you know, would have like a heater, like the old fashioned heater in the corner, and be mold everywhere.
Your feet in the way out.
One of them type of pubs. Yeah. And I'd be walking in here going, the state of this pub, and the barman's really rude and he's awful, and the crowd are really dry, and even the songs playing is terrible. And I have one drink and okay, I'm starting to feel okay. I have two drinks, I'm starting to feel a bit loose, and then I have three drinks, and the barman becomes my best friend. He's my soulmate. He just gets me. The crowd there are incredible. I love this song that's playing. I want the song played at my funeral. This pub is the greatest venue on earth. That was the impact that alcohol had on my life. That was like that 3-point world where everything just seemed phenomenal. Everything seemed amazing. All the problems they had, the childhood or the bills or the, you know, the trauma or the fucking anxiety, the low self-esteem, the fear, just all melted, didn't matter in that moment, you know. It was like this warm blanket just thrown around me, you know, and it was great. It fixed everything. If it was a broken nail or a broken marriage, alcohol fixed everything.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing someone say, you know, alcohol gave me the wings to fly and then it took away the sky. And that's what happened to me, you know. I drink and I didn't know, like, for me, like that high I talked about, in my addiction will kick in then and say the next drink will be even better. So I'm about 90% where I need to go, but I'll be 100% at the next drink. So it was always, I always suffer from more, than the disease of more, that the next drink will get me to where I want to be.
Yeah.
When the next drink was always my favourite drink, you know. So every time I drank 90% of the time I drank to oblivion, you know, because I didn't know.
Just a blackout.
If I couldn't drink 20 points, I wouldn't drink at all. We were sitting here and
you were a binge drinker?
I was a binge drinker, you know, and if we were sitting here and you said, Colin, you can have one drink, but that's all I get. And I said, I'm grand, I'll just have a course of cream. You know, I wouldn't take the drink. No. I wouldn't do that to myself because I'd be sitting there and I'd have this violent thirst on me for another one.
Yeah.
Just that disease and more would kick in. And, you know, it's like one is too many and 1,000 isn't enough.
Yeah.
You know, and I had this really good salesman that lived in my head that, you know, like no matter how bad it got, that if we stay off for a few weeks, I'd forget all the carnage and be like, do you know what, Colin? If you have one, it'd be grand. Because again, I had no tools for dealing with anxiety and feelings, and alcohol's a depressant. So the only solution I knew was a drink.
You took another one?
And I remember my ex partner threw me out of the house, and I had nowhere to go. And I rang a mate and said, "Here, Mark, we think of a drinking problem. Like, and you know, I think I need a bit of help. I need to get rehab." He goes, "Oh man, I'm sorry." He said, come on, we meet down the pub and we have a chat about it.
And that was a coping mechanism, really?
We went and had a pint off so we could talk about my drinking problem. And, you know, I remember going down with him and saying, "Yeah, man," I've sort of noticed that now. You've kind of gone a bit off the rails a bit. He goes, "You know what you need to do?" You know, I was expecting him to tell me, like, go to rehab or go see a therapist. And he goes, "Do you know what you should do? Eat a load of bread before you go out.
I've heard that before.
And a bit of milk, and that's so. And just come here.
I'll soak it up.
And start drinking. Stay off the spirits and start drinking Coors Light and Alka-Seltzer. Have a, you know." But it's not that he was doing anything right. That's all he knew.
You know,
it's just, you know, there has to be a way around it. You know, I remember when I was off the drink a year, I ran into an old drinking buddy. And he goes, "Oh, really, Colin, you still have to drink, are you?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, mate, I'm off it, yeah." And he goes, "Does that mean you just have a few cans at home now, is it?" You know, he couldn't conceive not drinking at all. Not even cans, like, you know.
But that's a culture we have too as well, do you know what I mean? And especially more so with, a binge drinking type of things too as well, 100%, like. Definitely.
Yeah, but your normal is your normal. Yeah. You know what I mean? I didn't class it as binge drinking. I just classed it as having a few.
You know,
just going for one and you're waking up in someone's fucking flower bed, or you're waking up in a police station, or, you know, you're waking up and not having a clue what happened or how you got there. And then you're waking up. And then as time went on, them hangovers and that fear and the anxiety that you got the next day, you just hated yourself and you had the shame. And do you know what you done last night? And you're afraid to pick up your phone and... You know, I suppose when I drank, it was like Russian roulette. I didn't know what type of drunk I was going to be. I didn't know if it was going to be the happy drunk, the sad drunk, the aggressive drunk, the violent drunk, the poetic drunk. Mm. It was Russian roulette, you know what I mean? And like every time I drank, I wasn't in trouble. But every time I was in trouble, drink was involved.
Yeah.
You know, and drink.
So where was the turning point then of you saying, "Do you know what, enough's enough"?
I came to my first meeting when I was about, my dad was in AA at the time. So, and I was about 18 at the time, and I got into trouble with the police, and my dad said, "Look, he promised he'd pay whatever the bill is." So I got drunk and just broke, didn't hurt anyone, but just caused a lot of damage to when I was drunk. And dad said, "Look, I'll pay the bill if you promise to come to an AA meeting with me." And I said, "All right." And so I got down to this meeting, and I'm in my head going, "Geez, what's it going to be like?" And I remember walking in, it was like people just sitting around in a circle, and everyone was actually really friendly, and they were all shaking my hand and saying welcome, and they even had fig rolls at my first meeting, and I'm a big fan of fig rolls.
Yeah.
And that was grand. And then the meeting ended, and I remember going home and thinking to myself, going, I like everything about AA bar the whole not drinking thing. I can't really get my head around that. And I end up going back, still going out to the pub, and I stayed off it for a couple of weeks, but inevitably I went back drinking because I wasn't ready to let go. I wasn't doing it for me, I was doing it for other people, to get the family off the back, or to get my girlfriend to take me back at the time, or, you know, get, like, whatever it was. I was doing it for theatre.
Mindset just wasn't there.
And you meet a lot of people on you know, trying to get sober or get clean or whatever. It's like, the sad thing is that it's to allow people go through their suffering. And, you know, it's like, you don't want to take the turkey out of the oven too soon because it's not cooked. And I just wasn't cooked yet. you know. And I remember when I went back out, you know, I was still young, you know, I was 18, and I went back out for 3 years, went back out drinking and whatever, and my mental health then started to take a very bad turn.
Yeah.
You know, I burnt bridges all around me, you know, I lost my job, relationships, you know, I was sleeping on my sister's couch, you know, I had absolutely nothing, everything was gone. And I was waking up in the mornings and didn't know whether to get a cappuccino or commit suicide. You know, right, that's how bad it
is. It's your darkest days, yeah.
Yeah, that's how bad my mental health. And alcohol is a depressant. So yeah. It's like you're throwing petrol on the bonfire.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And because all I knew was that quick kick gratification that alcohol gave me. But then it stopped working. It stopped being my mask. It stopped being my blanket. It stopped melting that fear where I couldn't walk down as far as the shop without having a panic attack. You know right. what I mean? I couldn't go into town without having a panic attack. You know, I was... my mental health was just like, it was just, my head was gone, and my whole family got invited down to Donegal for my dad's 60, and I wasn't invited because the last few family get-togethers I kind of blacked out and, you know, ended up wrecking them. So, and the family were kind of like, oh, maybe, you know, didn't want to kind of see me going down or whatever. And the sister says, oh, Colm, I'll pay for your room if you promise to come down and just not drink and whatever, you know. And the build-up to this was really struggling. And I said, oh, okay, I'll go down and I promise you I won't drink. So I got down to this hotel in Bundoran in Donegal called the Great Western Hotel. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking into the lobby and there was a big banner over the reception saying the All-Ireland Alcoholics Anonymous Convention.
Oh, God.
And I remember thinking, right here, there's not a chance I'm going to drink down like this, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm walking around, taking it all in, and I'm just like, oh, right here. And I end up sitting down, I don't know why, but just the Liverpool were playing and it caught my eye and I seen it was on the bar, so I said, right, I'll just walk in, get on my body. And I'm sitting there and this lad walks over and he's drinking a pint and I don't know how I managed to find the only other drinker at an AA convention and chatting to him. And he's like, yo, you see they're having an AA convention here? I was like, oh yeah, you're not one of them alcoholics, are you? And I was like, Jesus God, no. And he's like, do you want the drink? And I don't know what it is, that people pleaser in me, or you know, that need for approval, and you know, just straight away it was like, oh yeah, gosh, I'd have one, it'd be all right. And that's the insanity of my addiction, that even though I knew the consequences, it was like, yeah, I'd have one, like, you know. And with that, you know, it triggered that disease and more, you know. I had that first drink and then the salesman kicked in. I was like, do you know what, Colm, do you know what we'll do? We can go to the off license, get a few cans and sit up in the room and lock the door. No one will even know we're here. No one will even know we're drinking. I was like, okay.
And did you do that on your own?
Yeah, I had that drink. I told your man here, I'm gonna shoot, and went to the off license and bought a crate of cans and a bottle of vodka. It was on sale. And came back up the back door of the hotel, into the room, and I was like, yes, I smashed it, like, fair play. And next thing, I drank them and I blacked out for 2 days, and I woke up 2 days later in this hotel, and the police were in the room, my family were in the room, and the hotel manager in the room, and it caused nearly 6 grand worth of damage to this hotel.
Dear,
in a blackout
God.
That an AA convention was getting held. Thankfully, I didn't harm anyone.
No.
But I caused, like, just, I thought it was fecking, I thought it was a rock star or something breaking up a hotel.
Yeah.
And with that, I remember all the family just leaving the hotel room. I just remember the look that my mum gave me. And I just remember being riddled with shame. And everyone left, and I was just sitting there in the hotel room, my head in my hands, you know, and just being like, I can't do this anymore. And I made the conscious decision right there and then that I just wanted to end my life. And I felt very comfortable with that decision, if that makes sense. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know, it was a very hard thing to kind of explain, but I just felt like, yeah, this seems like the right thing to do. And as soon as we made that decision in my head, there was a knock on my door, and there was a lad, a young fella, a bit older than me, and he's like, oh, do you mind if we have a chat with you? I was like, yeah. And he came in, he goes, do you remember talking to me last night? I said, I can't remember talking to anyone. And he came in and he said, like, just telling me a bit of a story. He said, look, man, I'm a few years sober and I'm in AA, you know. And he started to talk about, like, all that stuff I described earlier on, that feeling, not feeling part of, feeling like a black sheep, never feeling worthy, never feeling good enough, you know, and using drink to kind of overcompensate them feelings and the blackouts and the consequences and all. And, you know, and straight away I was like, well, this fella, like, I can understand a lot of this stuff that this guy's talking about, you know. And it's just that being able to identify with someone, I felt a sense of belonging, like, and I felt this kind of alignment. And I just thought, well, yeah, he gets it. Like, you know, he understands it. Like, and he's like, do you want to come down and I can introduce you to a few more people? And there's an AA meeting on downstairs. And so he brought me downstairs to a meeting. And that was my last drink. That was 9 years ago. Coming into AA, I was 21 when I got sober as well, you know, and the life, I have a really good life today, you know, and I'm in love with my life. But, you know,
you've obviously went down a rocky road too as well. It wasn't obviously just plain sailing too, you know, you probably was tough too along the way.
100%. Because the drink wasn't the problem.
No.
The drink was the solution. So I had to get down to what the problem was, like, you know, and like that disease of more can manifest in anything.
Yeah.
I want more cars or more money or more validation or, you know, more lust or, you know, if we run more marathons or if do an Ironman. And it's that feeling 80%. And if I just get that thing, the thing can be the promotion or the validation or the online shopping or the gambling, whatever the thing is, to overcompensate that feeling of less than. And it was just like I had a really bad connection, you know. And when I talk about connection, it's not always like, you know, it doesn't have to be like a spiritual thing. It can be your own concept of connection. I'm quite a spiritual person, so I never struggled with the spiritual thing, but I never had a strong connection. It's like when you go out to some parts of the countryside and you just have really bad signal on your phone. That's what my connection was like.
Okay.
It was there, but it just wasn't very strong, like, you know. So when I got sober, I went down all these different rabbit holes. Like I got like codependency, got addicted to a person. You know, I remember I met a sponsor in when I started the 12 steps, and he said to me, look, Colm, in the first year of recovery, there's three things that we suggest.
Okay.
You don't go on holidays for the first year, you don't get into a relationship, and you don't go into any pubs. Just for your first year in recovery. I said, all right. Within a few weeks, I met a girl on holidays in a pub.
Oh,
you know, and
she did all three things I told you not to do.
And so I'm one of them people where I need to touch the stove so many times.
Yeah.
I have to learn the hard way. And but like that, you know, and I found that even like a couple of two or three years in my recovery, you know, I got a job and I became a workaholic.
Yeah.
So I still wasn't dealing with my trauma. I still wasn't able to sit with myself or sit with my feelings. And I was got a job and I was working about, you know, 50, 60, nearly 70 hours a week. And I got this company I worked up very fast because I was so addicted to my job. And people talk about nature and nurture.
Yeah.
But there's another element and I have. It's nature and nurture and just addict.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, is better than nature and nurture, because you get obsessed. And what the feeling was, that little feeling of gratitude, that quick hit gratification, that I loved the little tap on the back I got off my boss, or I loved that when I got money I could buy something online, and, you know, the quick hits. And, you know, I heard someone say I was suffering with the pig pandemic, which PIG stands for the problem of instant gratification.
Yeah.
I loved the escape that I got out of that, you know, just work, and that the next thing will keep me happy.
Yeah.
You know, destination addiction. And I've done that for years. And then I got to a stage, you know, where I was driving into my job and just having panic attacks and traffic jams, going, what the fuck's that all about? Like, you know, not knowing why. And my mental health was just like at an all-time low. And this is after being off the drink a few years.
And,
you know, and I didn't know why. And, you know, like that, I was struggling really bad. And I remember a mate of mine, he was mad into the sea dipping, and he's like,
yeah,
do you want to try come, you know, get into the sea and, you know, try that. So I got into the sea, and I remember the first time going down, Jesus, that was freezing. Like,
yeah,
I don't think I'd do that again. But I remember on the way home in the car with him, going, geez, I actually feel good after that, you know, a bit of a rush. And then he brought me down the second time, and then the third day we went, it was a great buzz, got coffee after. And I remember, like, this was good little thing, you know, kind of
started being part of your routine.
Yeah, starting to be part of my routine. And so we said, oh, I'm gonna go the next day. And then he said, I can't make it tomorrow, you have to go on your own. It was like, all right. So I ended up going down on my own and telling this bloke, oh yeah, I'm doing starting sea dipping, you know. And this is back when it wasn't trendy, you wouldn't see a lot of people doing it. And you know, this older dude said to me, oh, why don't you try it regularly, that's how you get used to it. So I said to myself, I'll get it, I'll go every day for 30 days. So, and that's what I've done, went every day for 30 days, and I loved it. And then at the end of the 30 days, I just remember this feeling I got, it was amazing, this feeling I found, this beautiful little thing that gave me a bit of a buzz, and that kind of put me back on the right track, you know. Mm-hmm. But what happened then after the 30 days, I remember driving home and I got a phone call saying my dad passed away, okay. You know. And I don't process emotions straight away. I don't know if it's from a young age I learned to desensitize.
Yeah.
You know, it was a coping mechanism.
No, I 100% get that, because there's times where I find I can be very emotionless.
Yeah.
Do you know? But I think it's a barrier sometimes I put up on myself.
Yeah. It's not empathy, it's like empathy. Like, I don't feel anything. And I remember getting a phone call saying my dad passed away. And then I went to mental
Was
family.
He sick or?
It wasn't expected. He wouldn't mean well, but he wasn't sick. Like, you know, that's all right. He was just out of shape, you know?
Yeah.
But, And then, you know what, I remember getting a phone call and that day going up to see the family and just like, this is surreal, like, you know, is this actually happening? And then I went to the gym and I ran into one of the lads in the gym and chatting away and joking and laughing, and I went for a swim and it still didn't hit me, and it was a couple of days and it didn't hit me, like, I remember talking to a guy and he's like, you know, this is how we process at the time. I still wasn't processing my emotions. That instead of feeling my emotions, like dealing my emotions, you know, that I handed in my notice in my job, you know, I signed up to all these triathlons, you know, I jumped out of a relationship, or I went traveling Asia, you know, I signed up to a Muay Thai competition.
You don't do things in half measures, do you?
But that's what I mean. I don't, but this is me feeling like, instead of, like, when you were talking about the moving at the start, you know, I found it real hard to sit with it, an actual house or an inner house that we can't actually sit there. We need to do, and this is what I became a human doing. I wasn't a human feeling or a human being. I was just a human doing. I started doing all these things, you know. And I remember a man rang me and he was like, "Hey, you know, come here. I'm really sorry about your dad there, but is everything all right?" I said, "Oh yeah, great." He goes, "Is anything else going on in your life?" "Oh yeah, well, I'm quit my job. I'm going traveling. I'm going to be a Muay Thai champion, and you know, and doing all the extreme things." And we're like, "Yeah, this is grand. This is fine." My local coffee shop down in Dunleary does a lovely. There's a great picture I love. It's like a picture of this little teddy and he's sitting in the house with a coffee and the house is on fire around him and it's just him smiling and there's a little bubble saying, "I'm fine, this is fine." Like, and that's what was going on.
You are the teddy.
Everything was falling down around me and I was just like, I was fine. And
did you think that was like part of your coping mechanisms too,
exactly,
as well?
Exactly. Like, trauma is a funny thing, you know what I mean? Like, and loss and grief, it's like there's no right or wrong way to deal with it or to process
it.
And everyone's kind of different. And
it's unique to everybody.
Yeah, and I'd always have a lot of energy. So I think one of my way of dealing this was to just keep moving, like, you know what I mean, to just be this, like, you know, the old saying, I don't know if it's a kind of well endorsed saying, but it's like depression can't hit a moving target, like, you know what I mean. So like that, I just keep going, don't stop, like, you know. And so I quit my job and I went traveling and went to Thailand to do my Muay Thai competition, and my first fight I won. My second fight I drew, but I got quite badly broke up, like I got quite a bad kind of, my face was in a bad way, and I remember being back in the hotel that night, and I had one fight left, and I got talking to this guy. He was on a wellness retreat doing a you know, a Buddhist, studying Buddhism, and he was like, "Oh, do you want to come along?" I was kind of talking, like, what really happened was the feelings were starting to come up then, because I got home from the hotel and I looked in the mirror and I just seen my whole face. I had a black eye, my nose, I was just smashed up. And I remember just looking in the mirror and just started bawling my eyes out, you know. And I just remember saying, "Why am I doing this? Like, what am I trying to prove? Am I trying to wear a mask? Am I trying to prove something to someone? You know, why am I doing this?" You know, I had my phone in one hand, took a picture, put it on Instagram as if I'm really cool. Yeah. And then, but in reality, I was fucking dying inside.
Yeah, you were in pain.
I was in pain, you know. And it's not even the physical. I can handle physical pain.
Yeah.
It's the emotional pain. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was, why am I? And just as I'm having this little cry, I walked out to the lobby and I got talking to this guy, and he was like, "Do you want to come around to this retreat?" You know, and I went along with him and I got talking to this Buddhist monk, and he was a really nice dude, and he was actually an ex, he's an expat, and he got into Buddhism, and he's studying a long, long time, became a monk, and, you know, we were doing this in Koh Samui, and I remember just having a chat with him when he seen my face, and he goes, we get a lot of people like you. I said, what do you mean a lot of people like me? And he says, it's not just people just trying to find themselves. You know what I mean? Because that was me again. I didn't know what avatar I was to play. I didn't know if I was the Muay Thai tough guy, if I was the funny football expert, if I was the, you know, the people pleaser, if I was the charmer, the poet, the artist, the nature guru. I didn't know what character I was to play because I didn't know myself from such a young age. You know, and I remember him just turning around to me and just, he said to me, look, one of the best mantras he has is that I am good enough regardless. And that's what he said to me. Just every time you're feeling a bit off, just say that to yourself. Yeah. So I am good enough regardless.
And that's stuck,
And that's stuck. And then he taught me how to meditate, you know. And with that, I started to work on my connection then. You know, when we come into recovery, we're told to kind of work on the 12 steps.
Yeah.
And the 12 steps is like a model designed to help you get a connection with a higher power. It deflates your ego, you make amends with the people around you, and you establish a connection with a higher power. 100%. I didn't do that stuff in early recovery, you know what I mean? I was looking for the other addictions, the workaholism, or the buying loads of stuff, or materialism, or consumerism, or validation on social media. Though I never actually went down the actual suggested route, and it wasn't until I got to this point that I was like, right, I'm sick of doing my way, it doesn't work anymore, you know? And with this, I went traveling then, was Vietnam, Cambodia, Bali. And I wasn't drinking at this stage. Like, no. I was 5 years sober. So like I was getting like 12 step meetings all over. It was crazy, like in jungles, on boats, you know, all over the place. It was great, you know, and to go on a sober trip. And like, even though I'm talking about this, it's like how my mental health was, like even to just do the stuff sober, like I couldn't like get a Lewis into town without having a panic attack. You know, the only like a bit of interrailing I did was getting on the dirt, like, you know, going to town.
Yeah.
Whereas now, like being able to travel the world on my own, sober, and not have any fear.
That's
powerful. And my problem wasn't the drinking problem, it was the fear problem.
Yeah, it was that anxiety. Fear
in me. And when I got home then from Thailand, you know, I just knew I wanted a change, you know what I mean? And I wrote a goals list and I wrote down, I want to do a marathon and, you know, I want to do an Ironman, I want to start a podcast and, you know, do all this stuff that, how can I give back and help people, like, you know, and I want to go back to college. And I wrote down this goal. I remember just someone said to me, look, dream, when you're writing a goals list, dream big, like write stuff that, you know, you think you'd never in your wildest dreams be able to achieve, you know, like doing the Ironman and all. Like, at this stage, you could barely run like 5K, you know, and that was 3 years ago, and I'm doing an Ironman now in October, and so it's incredible, like, you
amazing.
Know, I've done a half Ironman last year, and
I've seen that on your Instagram,
and it's like, it is, like, just the, you know, the ability to believe in yourself, because that's the thing, like, if you were to meet yourself, like, the best version of you, the only ideal version of you, the only difference between that person and you was that person believed in themselves, you know, and just like, the thing was that my problem was that I felt insecure about my differences and I felt insecure about being weird and I felt insecure about not fitting in. Whereas today I celebrate it, you know, and like, if you were to look at some of the best innovators in the world, you know, they're all big weirdos. So I love it, you know, and I love thinking outside the box. I love that I get such a buzz out of the sea, out of the moon, out of, you know, sunrise, a sunset, hiking, you know, all, like, my needs are so basic. My needs are beautiful. Don't get me wrong, everyone has wants.
Yeah.
But the problem with wants don't satisfy it. They merely give you a quick high and then it's a quick low, it's gone. Like, yeah, you know?
But that's a powerful tool to even have. Do you know what I mean? Like, even finding yourself again and, you know, going through all that is just, it's just remarkable. Like, I am truly blown away. Like,
yeah, but I think we need to go down them roads.
You do. I think especially with men. Do you know, definitely, do you know, men's mental health, and especially in Ireland, is just, at times can be crippling for, you know, men too as well. And, you know, like, I know we live in Derry too as well. Like, we've won the highest suicide rates.
Yeah, it's
sad, do you know what I mean? Sad, like, because men, not all men, obviously, but a lot of men compress their emotions and they don't know, you know, maybe it is drink or anything, you know, gambling, whatever, that they can't cope with that. And that's the only way that they can go about things. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's just...
But that, the mad thing is that it's that, like...
Like, it's amazing that you have them tools now that you know how to help with your anxieties and, you know, when you're doing your traveling and doing your marathons and all that there, do you know, like, it's obviously been a long journey through the past 9 years of being sober too.
But see, and that's the thing, like, we at the start of the podcast, we were talking about, like, academia and going to school and not being able to fit into the classroom, where I look at life as my life curriculum, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And that the struggles and my pain and my sorrow that I've had in the past is now my degree.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's my, you know, my wounds are my wisdom. You know what I mean? And my scars and my attributes.
100%.
And if I'm able to use that to strike a rapport, resonate with someone on a deeper level, to say, look, you're not on your own here. You know, I remember hearing this story, you know, this guy's stuck down a dark hole and he can't get out of it. And he sees a billionaire walking past. He says, please, mate, will you help me out of this hole? The billionaire writes him a check and throws it down, but he's still stuck down this hole.
Yeah.
He sees a priest walking past. He says, priest, father, will you help me get out of this hole? The priest says a prayer for him and walks past, but he's still stuck down this hole. Then he sees a doctor walking past. He says, please, doctor, will you help me get out of this hole? The doctor writes him a prescription and throws it down the hole, but he's still stuck down the hole. You know, he has his check, mm-hmm. his prescription and his check. And then he sees another man battling, you know, going through his own struggles, and he jumps down the hole. He goes, what are you doing, mate? Now the two of us are stuck down here. He says, yeah, mate, but I've been down here a few times. Follow me, I'll show you the way out. You know, and that's the powerful thing, that sometimes it's people that have walked the path that now look, you know, that you can always shine a bit of light in your dark, you know.
100%.
And that's what I've learned, that I've found my struggles and my darkness to be one of the greatest enablers and motivators I've had, you know, because In Buddhism, they have this little proverb that a lotus flower will only grow out of the mud, you know, and the mud being a metaphor for our struggle, our suffering,
mm-hmm.
you know. And if you, like, you know, we were discussing earlier on, you know, you were talking about you bought a little place down in Donegal on the holiday
caravan,
home. But where that came from was that your sense of struggle and just to get away.
It's just my escape. That was my escape.
But if you were to look at that as, like, it's a positive thing which came from a place of suffering or pain, like, you
absolutely.
Know. And if I was to look at everything, like, if I hadn't went through the suffering of my addiction, I wouldn't have got sober. And if I hadn't gone through the suffering of not dealing with my emotions, I wouldn't have had that experience you know, open up my kind of mind, you know, and help me get a bit of enlightenment, you mm-hmm. know. And there's a great saying, I think, Leonard Cohen says it, it's everyone's a bit cracked because it's the cracks that let the light in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's a powerful thing. It is good that we're all a bit cracked, because, like, everything starts in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, what time does the day start at?
What time does it start at?
Yeah.
My day?
No, just our day.
Our day? Probably about 6 in the morning, is it?
But if you were to think about a midnight, past midnight.
Aye.
It'd be 1 minute past midnight, say it's the start of the day. Yeah?
Yeah.
And it starts in dark. It starts in the darkness. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So everything starts in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I think maybe there is a narrative that, I don't know if it's the Disney narrative or the Happy Ever After, that we think that we're doing something wrong when we're going through struggles, or we're feeling anxious or feeling sad. And that, I think, makes things worse, when we feel like, because I'm anxious, I feel more anxious because I'm doing something wrong. But how come everyone on Instagram is so happy and pretty all the time, and I'm struggling? You know, it's and that endorses to even more bury it.
That does. Down, compresses that right down.
We don't want to open up and just say, you know, I'm struggling, because mm-hmm. it's not pretty to struggle, or it's not sexy or successful to feel anxiety or to feel low. And just what I feel today is that it's perfectly okay to forget ups and downs.
100%. Like, anybody that followed my journey, especially the first year, I was very open, very honest. Did a lot of crying. Like, I have all them videos, but I can't even look at myself in them because I don't even recognize that gear anymore. But I think that's where people would have connected to me. And that's probably where I've kind of started with the podcast and stuff, was I was getting inundated with messages all the time. Like, Brona, this happened to me. It could have been a divorce. It could have been a miscarriage. It could have been a loss of a parent, you know, a husband, a wife, whatever. But I think it was because I was so honest, and just, like, it got, obviously, I lost Berkey too as well, and the height of a global pandemic. So I think we locked down in the March, Berkey passed in April. So my only coping mechanism was, I'm in the depths of despair here and I'm so lonely that I'm just going to open up my phone and just talk on the camera. Do you know, that was the only way that I found that I could cope. Do you know what I mean? That was, that's all the way I could deal with it. Do you know, and I didn't care what I look like. I didn't care if there was a filter on it, if there was no filter on it. There was days I just sat in that car and I just sobbed my heart out. And a lot of people were like, oh, you know, really feeling for me. And then there was times people were like, I think you need help, you know, whatever. And I'm like, we're on the height of a global pandemic. That's the only way that I can offload here is to people that I've never met. Mm-hmm. Do you know, probably 95% of people on who I was talking to on Instagram, I had never met them before.
That's powerful,
and it just blew up from there. Yeah. But I think it was because I was so honest and so real and raw that I didn't care as long as people. And do you know what? I actually, Tracy, who was on there before ye, I actually met her through Instagram too as well. And I've met a lot of people who have lost siblings and, you know, widowed and children, everywhere forms of life. But I built that community myself. Do you know what I mean? And that was just me offloading and saying how I really, really felt.
That's powerful, isn't it? That's a beautiful thing when you realise that you're not walking this path on your own.
100%.
Like, don't be of being in that darkness or going through that sense of pain and grief. And like, for me, finding healthier ways to deal with your emotions, you know, yeah, your feelings. And that's why I find running, swimming, creativity, you know, good sleep, loads of water, good diet, you know, these are like my medicines for my mind, you know. And when I run or even when I swim or if anything that we can do to just help people, because again the stuff that you've been through, like that, you know, that's like you know, that's an attribute you've kind of earned now, you know, through going through all that pain and struggle. Like, you're a completely different person than the person you were a few years ago.
Absolutely.
I find like pain and struggle is like miracle growth for our growth, you know what I mean? And it's hard for us to see our own growth. Like, you know, if I'd say I met you 7 years ago, I met you now, I'd say you're a completely different person.
100%. 100%. And sometimes I don't even recognise her. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
But that's it. And we don't realise that our strength that we have. Like, if a couple of years ago, and you said it there, like, if I tell you this, that, the other's going to happen, you'd probably say, geez, I'd never be able to cope with that.
Yeah.
But it's only then when these big things happen, the deaths or the losses, that these things happen, that we realise the great power that we possess within us.
Yeah.
That's only comes when we're faced with these challenges. So I found that when I go through grief now or pain, that I know, look, I have enough in me to get through this. I can get through this, like, you know what I mean? And I found that over the years, even we're talking to friends and that like pain can catapult us to great places as well. Yeah. You know what I mean? That if
it gives you that fire sometimes in your stomach that you need, that inner strength.
Fire in your belly, because I'd still be living that mediocre life, that grey life, 9 to 5, never doing anything spectacular with my life, just on the hamster wheel, you know? And if it wasn't for me pain that catapulted me out of that, I'm not actually living my life. Because you realise the futility of life when people do pass away around us, and we realise how short life is. And I'm saying now, right, if I was sitting on my deathbed, what would I do differently right now?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If I could click my fingers and I'm sitting on my deathbed, what are the sort of things that I'd regret? You know, and that's why I said, right, I'm gonna stop listening to that inner critic in my head.
Yeah.
Stop listening to that doubt and stop worrying about what the people around me would say about me or judge me for wanting to go and follow something that might be my dream. I don't even know what my dream is. I still don't.
No.
Maybe it's an Ironman. Maybe it's like, you know, maybe it's traveling. Maybe it's doing the podcast. Like, we never truly know what are that. It's always changing. The goalposts are always changing.
But that's good too as well. Yeah, 100%. Do you know, 100%?
No, I don't think anyone truly knows, you know.
Definitely not.
But the thing is to strive towards it. Just to always be growing and always trying to be better people, to try and always improve and try and improve the people around us, like, you know what I mean? And my goal today is, like, how can I make the world a better place for me and the people around me, you know what I mean? And just try and be a service, like, you know what I mean? I know that all the life experiences that I've accumulated in my life today helps me today to connect with other people and to try and give back. And if it's putting out a positive message, if it's, you know, saying, look, I used to be 20 stone, I was a chronic alcoholic. Yeah, yeah.
Jeez.
I was 20 stone overweight. No yeah, way. Yeah. It was 19.6. I'm your heaviest. Yeah, yeah.
My God.
Yeah, yeah. It's back when we were going between comfort eating and, you know, snorting lines of fucking custard creams, you know. You know. Just to know that the change is always possible. We're never alone. Even though our depression or our addiction or our mental health will tell us that we're alone, where nobody wants us around, we're pieces of shit, whatever that inner head is telling you, it's all crap.
Yeah.
You know, and then I love that when I meet up with a few of my pals and we have this open, honest, raw conversation and someone sets the tone, someone shows their vulnerability, and straight away we're all just having this very vulnerable, honest and raw conversation.
Yeah.
And that we walk away from that, well, I thought I was the only one that struggled with that. You know, I thought I was the only one that felt that, I got that. And then you start to hear other people are getting it, and straight away you get that sense of, oh well, I'm not alone.
100%.
You know, of that sense of belonging. So like even you picking up the phone and ringing a friend, say, look, I'm struggling today, and
that's powerful. Honest to God, you have literally blown me away today. Honest to God, amazing. Like such a good podcast. I swear to God. Honest to God, thank you so much for coming on and having this little chat.
Thanks for having me. Oh. It was lovely. It was lovely. Good stuff does happen over the north side of Dublin. I didn't realize. I didn't realize.
Brilliant.